As we're talking about the judicial branch of the United States of America, more specifically the Supreme Court, the word integrity becomes a critically important word. Judges must maintain the highest standards of personal conduct and practice, and they practice integrity, hopefully, each and every day. A judge must possess honesty, integrity, impartiality, must be self-controlled and upright. Judges must practice patience and dignity and respect towards all litigants, jurors, witnesses, and lawyers. Now, I think that's a reasonable expectation for the type of job that a judge is doing, that a judge would be full of integrity and be honest and be impartial and have self-control. All of those things are critically important. But when I think about that being the standard, that being the basis for being a judge, I wonder how important it is for you and I to be like that. The importance of doing right as a Christian, integrity for Christians. I think the Apostle Paul says it really well in Philippians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9. He talks about two different ideas. He talks about one idea for you to think about something, and the second idea is for you to do something, to put it into practice. He says this, he says, finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there's any excellence, if there's anything worthy of praise, think about these things. And what you've learned and received and you've heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the promise is that the God of peace will be with you. What a great thing. All of these different attributes that Paul talks about in his letter to the church at Philippi are so important. And the starting place for all of them in the passage is your heart. He wants you to think about them. You see, I don't think you can be an integrous person if it isn't really here in your heart. From your heart, your mouth speaks. And hear what Paul is saying to all Christians is you need to work on your heart. You need to think about these things. And isn't it interesting, the things that he talks about here in this letter are things that we would expect from a Supreme Court justice. And then he goes further. He says, you know, once they're here in your heart, let the world see them. Practice them. Make it a part of who you are. There's a think about, and then there's a do. As we go through this next episode today, I think it's so important for us not to just look at the judge and say, well, the judges have to have that, but rather Christians are being held to the same level of integrity, the same level of honesty. That should be true of us as well. We left things off in a very, very disturbing place. And it was racism. It was a place of equal but separate. It was a place that we looked at and said that, you know what, we're going from slavery, and we say slavery is a really bad thing, and we're moving from slavery to something called segregation. And it would be only appropriate after looking at Plessy v. Ferguson for us to see the case that changed everything, that overturned the idea of segregation and brought the United States of America into a different place altogether. And it's this case right here. It's called Brown versus the Board of Education in Topeka. Now, the plaintiff in this case is a man by the name of Oliver Brown. He was a parent. He was a welder in the shops of the Santa Fe Railroad. And guess what? He was also an assistant pastor at his local church. He was also Afro-American. If you look at America at this time period, you could see how segregation in some places was absolutely mandated, that black students would have a black school to go to and white students would have a white school to go to. You can see most of the Mid-Atlantic all the way through Texas and the Deep South had what was called mandated segregation. Other states had no segregation legislation at all, but did the same thing as the red states did. And some had optional and and some had a place where segregation was forbidden. And it's not surprising where segregation is forbidden. If you know the Civil War, those seem to be the abolitionist states. They come along first, and they become the first integrationists in this topic. But it's very important for us to be able to see this and place ourselves in post-World War II and say, this is the way the United States worked. And here's a picture right here of Oliver Brown and his daughter. Brown's daughter, Linda Carol Brown, was a third grader, and she had to walk 6 blocks to her school bus stop just to ride to Monroe Elementary, which was her segregated black school, which was a mile away. Problem was, Sumner Elementary, a white school, was just 7 blocks from her home. The other problem was that during the day after school was out, all of her friends were white, and most of them were. And they were integrated in the community. And all of her white friends went to a different school, which she couldn't be part of. As directed by the NAACP leadership, the parents each attempted to enroll their children in the closest neighborhood school in the fall of 1951. So basically, the NAACP was coming to a place of saying, look, let's test this. Let's take it to the next level. So Oliver went to Sumner Elementary and said, I'd like to get my daughter, Linda, to this school. In each case of this test, they were refused enrollment and directed to a segregated school. In the early 50s, the NAACP brought a class action suit against schools and school districts in several states, seeking court orders that would require the districts to allow black children to attend white schools. The original case was tried in a district court and was defeated on the grounds that the black schools and the white schools were sufficiently equal, and therefore segregated schooling in the district was protected under the Plessy v. Ferguson decision. Remember what Plessy and Ferguson came out with. They came out with, look, we're still going to be separate, but we'll be equal. And here in Topeka, Kansas, if you looked at the schools in terms of the quality of school for the black students and for the white students was pretty equal. Here in Topeka, at least, the quality of the teachers was pretty equal. The resources that they had was fairly equal. So when the state ruled on it and the state Supreme Court ruled on it, based on Plessy, what's being offered to these people is equivalent. It's equal, and equal is more important than anything. The Supreme Court decided to hear the case in 1954. The chief counsel for the NAACP, the person that was representing the Brown family, was a guy by the name of Thurgood Marshall. Do you know that name? He's later on going to become the first black justice appointed to the Supreme Court. And like I told you, and here's an original copy of the complaint, the lower court ruled against the Brown family, and they focused on comparisons of basic facilities offered in both the schools. And by contrast, the Supreme Court case involved a much more in-depth analysis, looking at the effects that the different environments had on the students. And that becomes a really big deal. You see here, what was taught to people is that race mixing is similar to communism. And all of the big protests that happened in Washington, D.C., and you can see this is one of many, was that if you were someone that decided to have black students integrated with white students, that made you a communist. Now, during this time period, what was going on was the communist scare as well. So if you could tag that along to somebody and say, well, because you believe in integrationism, you're a communist, that was a double hit. And a lot of people bought this. So they look at the environments. They say, well, wait a second. Let's get beyond just the resources being equivalent. But what about the learning environments for the students? The court determined that segregation led to lower self-esteem, lack of confidence that could affect a child's ability to learn. It found that separating students by race sent the message to black students that they were inferior, to white students, and therefore schools serving each race separately could never, ever, ever be equal. The Brown decision was truly significant because it overturned the separate but equal doctrine established by the Plessy decision. This is the critical basis right here, was that Plessy Ferguson was no longer the law of the land. This new ruling would be, and separate but equal was now pushed off to the side. You see, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution guarantees equal protection under the law. And the court ruled that separate facilities based on race was therefore unequal. One piece of evidence that greatly influenced the Supreme Court decision was based on research that was provided by two educational psychologists, Kenneth and Mammy Clark. And what the Clarks did is they presented children as young as 3 years old with white dolls and brown dolls. They found that overall the children rejected the brown dolls when asked to pick which dolls they liked the best and wanted to play with and they thought was a really nice color. That was enough for the Chief Justice at that time, Earl Warren, to get a unanimous ruling on this topic. They voted many times, and Warren would not issue this ruling until he convinced all other eight justices that if we're going to overrule Plessy Ferguson, we're going in, and we're going in hard, 9-0. And that's what he did. And what he said is, we conclude that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has absolutely no place. And separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. And the lasting feeling of inferiority created in black children by segregated schools deprives them of the 14th Amendment. It deprives them of equal protection in the eyes of the law. This was a big moment. Do you remember that map I showed you? That map with the red states? Well, the red states did not roll over on this law very quickly. And if you know your history and from the problems in Alabama and such, what those red states is, they delayed and they delayed and they delayed and they protested and they would not accept the Brown v. Educational Board ruling. Here's a mom with her daughter and getting the good news that the court, with integrity, right, being honorable and doing what was right, said no to this form of racism. When Warren delivered the opinion of the unanimous court, the Supreme Court held equally that separate but equal facilities, unequal, can't do it. And the court reasoned that the segregation of public education on the basis of race instilled, again, and here's his words, a sense of inferiority. And what do we talk about all the time in the Bible is that you, regardless of the color of your skin, your nationality, and who you are, you're image bearers of God himself. Makes you intrinsically valuable. And in that intrinsic value, then we can't say that one person, based on the color of their skin or their nationality, is greater than someone else in that sense. This is a ruling the court got right. Now, they didn't use necessarily a Bible verse, but the 14th Amendment worked out very well here in terms of the equal response for all people, regardless of color in this case. So now we're going to talk about religion, and we're going to talk about some of the earliest cases of religion. What we'll talk about today are really good cases. We're going to talk in a minute here about a case that involved the Church of the Latter-day Saints. It's the earliest religious case that we have on record. We're going to talk about the Lemon Test, and we have to get that in our minds and hearts and understand it, because the Lemon Test is still what is used today when trying to ascertain what is constitutional and what is not constitutional with regard to religion. We're also going to talk about whether a federal or state employee, even if the Constitution says so in the state, must believe in God to hold a position with the state. This is a huge case, and the implications in this case were vast. And lastly, we'll look at a case that talks about working on Sundays, the Blue Laws. And some of those blue laws are still in effect today. And the court is going to have to decide whether the blue laws in restricting you from working on Sunday is a religious thing. And if it is, it would violate the Establishment Clause. Or if there's some other reason for that. And the last thing we're going to do is a hook. Is going to hook you for October. Probably be the most disturbing case that I've read yet in the dockets of the Supreme Court. And it will lead to something that will surprise you about how we look at modern decisions in the modern world that we live in. But talking about religion and talking about these social issues are very important for us. The importance of seeking truth, the truth that comes from God's true and holy word. We live in a world today where religion is sought to be okay if it's a religion that's palatable for the culture. But if your religion says there's an exclusivity as to who God is, if your religion also would say the Bible, the source of the knowledge it comes from, is the only book where real truth would come from, then that kind of religion, in the eyes of the Constitution and in the eyes of the culture, needs to be dealt with differently, and it has been dealt with differently. And that means that we're going to need some, hopefully, different skills, some different ideas as to how we approach what's happening in the culture today. The book that's up there, it's called Believe, The Battle Over Religious Liberty in America. Everybody should have a copy of it. I have plenty of them in the bookstore, and you should read it. It's a very good read. Luke Goodrich is a Christian attorney. His law firm was on the Hobby Lobby case and a couple of other very large cases. It's a very important resource. I would recommend every person, every Christian, read it. Dr. Moeller interviewed him recently on Thinking in Public, which is another resource that I think you should be part of. And he interviews Goodrich for an entire hour. And the things they talk about are things that we've been talking about here. But what should the church do with all these social issues? What is the church's obligation? C.S. Lewis said this: how we change the world for Christ is going to be an important thing. The judicial branch will never be able to do more than the gospel and more than Jesus Christ and the cross of Christ. But he says this, he said, if you want to really change the world, people often expect the church to take the lead. But of course, when they ask for a lead from the church, most people mean that they want clergy to put out a political program. His comment to that? That's silly. And I join him in that. We're asking them to do a quite different job for which they have not been trained. Instead, we need to see the job is really on us. It's on the layman. The application of Christian principles, say, to the trade unionism and to education, that's got to come from the Christian trade unionist. It's got to come from the Christian school masters. And just like Christian literature comes from Christian novelists and Christian dramatists, not from the bench of the bishops getting together and trying to write plays and novels in their spare time. You see, the church's response is not going to come from brick and mortar and from programs. The church's response is going to come from the church itself. And the people are the church. And your impact in your job, in your community, and how you present the gospel, and how you present yourself, how you think about those things like Paul was talking about, and how you practice them on a billboard in front of others, is the best thing the church could ever do to combat any social injustice in this world. So the church's response will come from the people, as the church is the people. Now, a couple of things you need to understand. The Establishment Clause. It basically, the Constitution says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That's any religion, not just Christian religion. It's Judaism, it's Islam, it's any religion. We can't do that is what the government is saying. That's what the Constitution is saying. And the other thing they can't do is they can't prohibit your free exercise thereof. One of our cases that we look at today is on door-to-door evangelism. And the reason that after today, if you wanted to go out to the streets of your neighborhood to share your faith and knock on people's doors, is because a case we'll talk about that happened in 1940. It's your free exercise of religion. Those two ideas are very, very important. Now, you've heard me talk about the lemon test. The lemon test is very important as well for you to understand. It's a case called Lemon versus Kurtzman. Quickly, just summarizing the case, what happens here is 1971, is two states, Pennsylvania and Rhode Island, their governments have decided that they're going to provide some money, some funding for some of the private schools and some of the private religious schools. And the funding is going to be aimed not at religious studies, not at Old Testament survey or anything to do with the Bible, but, you know, the school needs a math teacher or might need a science teacher. So something that is maybe a little bit more of a secular topic inside of a Christian school. And as Christian schools, they are receiving money now from the state of Rhode Island and also from the state of Pennsylvania. Lemon is a guy that is a taxpayer and also someone that is not a believer. And he is totally angry that any government would put money into any private religious school. And he says that that violates the Establishment Clause. And that puts this case to the test. And in this case, Lemon versus Kurtzman, many things come from it. Now, the Lemon test looks like this. There are three parts to it. One is, if there's a secular purpose, that's okay. So in the Lemon versus Kurtzman case, it was a secular purpose. It was for math. It was for science. So we're okay. Did it advance or inhibit religion? Now, either way, Establishment Clause, free exercise. Did it violate either of those two things? No, it really didn't. We're talking about something that's different than religion. Two for two, looks like they might win. The third one is no government entanglement. Now that they got in a little bit of trouble with. No government entanglement. And that's a little bit more nebulous. Anton Scalia was a person that looked at the Lemon test and said it's like a ghoul in a cemetery that can just rise up whenever it wants and be used for whatever purpose. And he said, really, whoever's making that last charge right there and writing the majority opinion because of government entanglement, it's whatever that guy thinks, and it's totally subjective, not like the first two items. And in Lemon versus Kurtzman, the government actually did come to a place where they looked at this and said, you know what, there's too much entanglement. There's too much accounting to figure out how all of this works. And they ruled against both of those states and overturned the help they were getting. But the big part is that is what's used today, the Lemon test. Please remember it as you're listening to the news and you're seeing how things are working out there. Those three bars, secular purpose, neither advancing or inhibiting religion, and then finally, no government entanglement. And the no government entanglement is the one that will drive you nuts trying to figure out, wait a minute, how did they get there? The first religious case ever that happens in this country that makes it to the Supreme Court is a case called Reynolds versus the United States, 1879. Reynolds was the first Supreme Court opinion to address the First Amendment's protection of religious liberties, impartial juries, and the confrontational clauses of the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution. Now, who is Reynolds? George Reynolds was a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He was a Mormon, and he was charged with bigamy under the Moral Anti-Bigamy Act after marrying a second woman, Amelia Jane Schofield, while he was still married to Mary Ann Tudham in the Utah Territory. Now, Utah doesn't become a state until 1896. This case is in 1879, but still they live under the jurisdiction of the federal government. Now, this Reynolds guy is interesting in another way. He has a job, and his job is he's a primary secretary to a man by the name of Brigham Young. Now, Brigham Young, this is a picture of most of his wives. You see Brigham in the middle, and the belief was 55 wives altogether. So my PowerPoint slide wasn't large enough to accommodate his world. Reynolds goes to court and basically says this: my religion allows me to have more than one wife, then the federal government's not allowed to stomp on my religion. I can do what I would like. And the government countered, well, we have anti-bigamy laws that are bigger than your religious right to do what you want to do. And by unanimous decision, the court held that while Congress could not outlaw a belief in a correctness of polygamy, it could outlaw the practice of it. So in other words, they said, you know, you can believe in whatever you want, just don't practice it because it's against our law. The majority reasoned, and while marriage is a sacred obligation, it is nevertheless usually regulated by law. And in most civilized nations, that's what we see. And finally, the court held that people cannot avoid a law due to their religion. And I think that's important. You'll see a lot of that today with the Christian Science people that don't want to get treatment for their kids. And so that is a big deal right off of this case as well. Interestingly enough, if you read newspapers, did you see what Utah did last week? They decriminalized polygamy. And in this polygamous world that is up in the Utah area, they had enough support that their senators in committee ruled unanimously to decriminalize polygamy. So the next stop is, I think, in 2 weeks in their House of Representatives, and the governor's already said that he will go ahead and sign that law. So there's a good chance by summertime in Utah, polygamy will be a thing again in that community and among the people of the LDS faith. Okay, Cantwell versus Connecticut, door-to-door evangelism. And look who it is. Our first case, LDS. Look at our second case, Jehovah Witnesses. In this case, Newton Cantwell, his two sons, travel to New Haven, Connecticut. They're going to promote the message of the Jehovah Witnesses. The neighborhood that they go into to evangelize is primarily a Catholic neighborhood. It's a very prestigious neighborhood, a lot of rich people that are living there, and they are going to go door to door and share their faith. In New Haven, Connecticut, a statute required anybody wishing to solicit funds or distribute materials had to apply for a license. You had to apply for a license and pay for one. Now, the Cantwells did not apply for a license because, in their opinion, the government was in no position to certify the witnesses as a religion. They said, basically, at a lower level government area, you can't decide whether we're a religion or not. We're doing what we want to do. We have faith. We're protected by the Constitution. And we have a First Amendment right to express our faith. And that means going door to door. We could do that. Now, the people in New Haven were rather rich. This was a rather affluent neighborhood. And they threw all three of these Jehovah Witnesses right in the hoosegow. They put them right in jail. And so they had a little bit of money. The Jehovah Witnesses did. They bailed them out. They got them attorneys. They fought in the state of Connecticut at a lower level. And they lost. Supreme Court, the state of Connecticut, and they lost all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court now is going to have to decide Jehovah Witnesses, and the history of Jehovah Witnesses with the government is not a good history. We're going to find out that Jehovah Witnesses in the next year are going to sit down and say that we are not going to do the pledge to the flag and see if they get support from the government on that as well. So the Jehovah Witnesses are a little bit of a burr in the saddle of the United States government and also in the community as well. Because they're going into this community in Connecticut. It's not like we do, where you just knock on the door and go, "Hi, we're with Compass Bible Church. We'd like to invite you to church." They're going up and they're saying, "You guys are Catholics. You know what? You're going to go to hell. And you guys are preaching a wrong religion. You're heretics." They're going all out. And this is 1940. You know what else? They have a portable phonograph. And they're playing a teaching called Enemies. And what they're saying is that Roman Catholics, the Pope, and everybody, you're all enemies. And you're enemies of God. And so they were shaking the community up here a little bit. Now, as a result, they were convicted under the statute that we just talked about, which forbade the unlicensed soliciting of funds or religious or charitable purposes, and also under a general charge of the breach of the peace, because they've been going door to door with books and pamphlets and in a predominantly Roman Catholic area. And they were playing that record I told you was called Enemies, which attacked Roman Catholics. They really caused a riot in this community. Cantwell alleged that the statute that he'd been convicted under infringed upon their right to free speech, and he challenged it in the courts. Now, Justice Roberts was writing the majority opinion for the Supreme Court. By the way, the Supreme Court fell on the side of the Jehovah Witnesses unanimously, 9-0, for their freedom to go door to door with probably a faith that none of those justices thought was a legitimate faith at all. But constitutionally, what they believed was that regardless of what your religious faith is, the Constitution allows you as a U.S. citizen the right to go door to door and express your faith with anybody that you would like, as long as you don't punch them, hit them, or incite a riot. So the idea that the statutes requiring a license to solicit for religious purposes constituted a prior restraint upon speech, it gave the government way too much power. This is a state government in Connecticut, in determining which groups were permitted to solicit. The officer who issued licenses for solicitation was authorized to inquire whether the applicant did have a religious cause to decline a license if, in his view, the cause was not religious, which gave the government officials way too much authority over religious questioning. Now, that kind of censorship of religion as a means of determining its rights to survive is a denial, the court said, of liberty protected under the First Amendment and included in the liberty, which is within the protection of the 14th Amendment as well. Now, the breach of the peace accusation arose because the three accosted two Catholics in a strongly Catholic neighborhood and played them a phonograph record, which in their opinion insulted the Christian religion in general and the Catholic Church in particular. So these Catholics are like, they're assaulting us. They're not hitting, there's no battery, but they're assaulting us, and we can't have that. So the court looked at that as well. The court voided that conviction as well. Under what test? Well, no, not in the Lemon Law. This is, are you dangerous? Oliver Wendell Holmes. Are you a clear and present danger? And they used and applied Oliver Wendell Holmes's thinking, the clear and present danger test, and they ruled that these guys were not a clear and present danger to these people. And they didn't justify the suppression of the religious views that just simply annoyed one another. So you can annoy somebody constitutionally, but you can't hit somebody and can't cause a riot. But you can annoy people by spreading the message. And so this unwelcome and disturbing message, and there was no physical attack to anyone, was all allowed and guaranteed by the Constitution. Now, the decision is also notable because it was the first time that the court had incorporated a free exercise clause into the 14th Amendment, and after this case, it always has. Cantwell v. Connecticut is the case that allows the church, at least to this day, unless there will be another case that comes up that says crazy Christians can't go door to door and express their faith. Or if you would want to, and you go to the town center today, you can express your faith there as well. And so all of those things really come as a result of a couple of Jehovah's Witnesses, dad and a couple of boys, going into a Roman Catholic neighborhood, causing a stir, and it got all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court reminded the American people that the First Amendment gives you a freedom of speech to speak your religion anytime, any place. Let's talk a little bit about Earl Warren, because you're going to notice on our cases, look at all four of them. Brown versus the Board of Education, Earl Warren was the Chief Justice on that one. He wasn't around for Cantwell, but our last two cases, Turcaso Watkins and Brownfell Brown, were all part of the Warren Court as well. So it's important for us to know a little bit about Earl Warren. He was born in Los Angeles in 1891, lived in Bakersfield, California most of his life. He went to UC Berkeley, where he got a political science degree, finished his JD there, and brought onto the bar here in the state of California. From 1920, and this is really interesting, until his retirement from the Supreme Court in 69, he served without interruption in public office, and that's pretty amazing. He had been a district attorney in Alameda County for a number of years and developed quite a reputation as a crime fighter. If you look at the Miranda case, something that he really was instrumental because of his career in dealing a lot with criminal elements in Alameda County. He was also a member of the Board of Regents for UC system. He was a Republican first and had the broad bipartisan support because he was a centrist in his beliefs. He's the only person in California to be elected to the governorship for three consecutive terms, 42, 46, and 1950. And wait till I tell you this. In 1946, he was the only governor in history to win an election unopposed. There was nobody that opposed him. And the reason was he won the Democratic, Republican, and progressive primaries. In 1948, Thomas Dewey asked Earl Warren to be on the ticket with him, and they went against Harry Truman in the big upset. Earl Warren would have been the vice president of the United States had Dewey won. In 53, Dwight D. Eisenhower appointed Earl Warren the 14th Chief Justice of the United States. And besides the work on the court, Warren also headed the commission to investigate the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Earl Warren retired from the bench in 1969, died in 74, and he's buried in Arlington National Cemetery. Earl Warren has had quite an impact on our country. He's a guy that you probably should read a little bit more about to get to know. Someone that's been a governor here for three terms in a row. A guy that won all three political primaries. When has that ever happened? And the cases that he's handled are all landmark cases. And so learning a little bit more about Earl Warren than I just provided you might be a good summer read if you're looking for a biography, and there are several out there. Here's a picture of Earl Warren with the Kennedys, and then down below here, swearing in another Californian, Richard Milhouse Nixon. Do you have to believe in God to be employed by the government? That's the question we're going to answer here. Do you have a right as a public employee to not believe? And in other words, does your right to religious freedom give you the same right not to believe in religion? And I think that's a good question, because so many state constitutions, not our federal constitution, now we're talking about state constitutions, are quite religious, and they haven't been changed. A number of them talk about Jesus Christ in their state constitutions as Lord and Savior. And in the state of Maryland in 1961, if you were going to be an employee anywhere in the state, you would have to affirm a belief in God. And if you didn't, then you would not be able to be an employee in the state of Maryland. So Turcaso and Watkins becomes an interesting case. It's the issue that the Supreme Court dealt with in 61. Roy Turcaso sought an appointment from the state of Maryland to become a notary, and it allowed him, as notaries do, to attest to signatures of people signing documents, and he completes all the requirements for becoming a notary, and he's appointed as a notary public by the governor of the state of Maryland. But there's a big problem. His commission was denied when Turcaso, who was a professed atheist, refused publicly to declare a belief in God as required by the Maryland Constitution. Now, that's a big problem. So they look at Turcaso and they say, no way. And he does what a lot of people do. He goes to state court, he goes to state Supreme Court, and he loses, and he has to go to federal court. What's going to happen later in the early 70s is the Lemon Test. It's not here yet. But what I told you is that a couple of things that are quite important for us as Christians to remember: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So two different ideas. The Constitution, a federal constitution, cannot have an established religion. It's not allowed. So when people say the government is a Christian country, we're not. There's a total separation. The framers had this separation in mind from the very beginning between the government and the church. They didn't want to have the Church of England in the United States of America. So there's no law respecting an establishment of religion. And then secondly, you could believe in whatever you want. You could go door to door today, and if you're a witch or a Wiccan, you would still have the free exercise of believing that, and the Constitution would protect you, even though people would find it deplorable, as long as you didn't do something violent or challenge people to a fight. You have that ability to believe it. Now, Turcaso is saying that I fulfilled everything, and I'm appointed as a notary. And now as a notary, do I get the job or not? And the governor of Maryland says, you do not, because you will not attest to a belief in God. And so all the way to the Supreme Court it goes. And if you look in the outline with me, you'll see that the Constitution states this, that no religious test ought to ever be required as a qualification for any office of profit or trust in the state, wait for it, other than a declaration of belief in the existence of God. So Turcaso sued the state of Maryland Circuit Court, claiming the requirement violated his First and 14th Amendment rights under the Constitution. The court dismissed his suit, and he appealed to the Maryland State Court of Appeals, the state's highest court, and the court affirmed the circuit court's ruling, and Turcaso had no other choice but to go and seek federal relief, and the court took his case. Now, the First Amendment has two clauses that provide religious freedom to citizens. The Free Exercise Clause prohibits the government from infringing on a person's right to worship and engage in religious activities, and the Establishment Clause, which prevents the government from establishing a religion. Just what it says right there, right? Those are the things you have to remember when you're looking at the United States Constitution. And Turcaso is going to the Constitution, he's going to the Supreme Court going, look, these people in Maryland are establishing a religion, and I have to believe what they're believing, and they're part of the government. I want some relief for that. When the Constitution was accepted by all 13 colonies, the rights found in the Constitution were enforceable only against the federal government, but not against state governments. until the 14th Amendment, which was ratified in 1868, which extended many of those fundamental rights to citizens of states. So now the federal government has a stronger hold on states. States are not the law of the land. The Supreme Court, the federal part of our country, is the law of the land. Basically, Roy is looking up and saying to the Supreme Court, this state right here is holding me back from what I richly deserve, which is to be a notary republic, because they want me to believe in their religion, and I don't believe in their religion. Would you inform them that that's not in the United States Constitution, please? And that's exactly what happens. See, the 14th Amendment, which is ratified, gives the federal government, the Supreme Court, the power to do that. And at the time of the present case, this included religious freedoms that were found in the First Amendment, Article 6, Section 3 of the Constitution, which prohibited religious tests as a requirement to hold any federal public offices. Now, this meant that requiring a person to pronounce their faith or a denomination of faith to hold federal public office was fully prohibited. Now, you think back in our history a little bit. Right after the Constitution, it was nearly impossible if you were a Roman Catholic to hold any public office at all or to be Jewish. So a lot of those things that were held by states could be held by states, and the federal government really didn't have the power to say, you can't do that. And so the United States Constitution, in the free exercise of faith and the Establishment Clause, really starts gaining its teeth later on down the line with cases just like this, which is a landmark case. The Constitution of the State of Maryland specifically stated that their clause was not a religious test, even though it required a belief in God. The Supreme Court said, you're nuts. And holding some kind of requirement in the place of the State of Maryland firmly on the side of the people who believed in God, that is a religious right. And with this requirement, Maryland effectively aids religions that profess a belief in God at the expense of any form of belief or disbelief in any other form. The First Amendment expressly prohibits a state from taking this position. And although the candidate has the option of not pursuing public office rather than declaring a belief in God, the test is unconstitutional encroachment on the freedom of religion. And Justice Felix Frankfurter and Justice John Harlan concurred in that result. It was a unanimous decision for Mr. Tocasio. He became a notary public, and the first piece that he notarized was for his daughter, and they had a big deal about all of that, and he went on as a notary. 9-0, because governments are not allowed to establish any form of religion. They just can't. They can't do it. And that Felix Frankfurter guy, he's not the Chief Justice, but he's a justice in the Supreme Court, born in Austria, in Vienna, in Wien, becomes a U.S. citizen kind of later, and has a lot of ideas that are quite different than you and I would have about what America should be all about. Remember, we talked about being part of the Supreme Court. Don't have to be a U.S. citizen. Matter of fact, there's hardly any qualifications at all to be on the Supreme Court. Another Warren specialty right here. It's a landmark case, Brownfeld versus Brown, 1961. This is a case that is really about something called the Blue Laws. Do you remember the Blue Laws at all, where everything used to be closed on Sunday and you couldn't go to the mall and you couldn't go shopping, and then slowly but surely things kind of changed a little bit. Blue Laws are an interesting thing. They are still in existence in our country. I don't know if you know that, but in Arkansas, there are 75 counties in Arkansas. 39 of them are still dry. You can't buy alcohol there at a liquor store. In Illinois, you can't buy a car on Sundays. All our car dealerships are closed. Minnesota, car dealerships are closed on Sunday. Mississippi, the sale of alcohol is verboten on Sunday altogether. You can't do it. In New Jersey, Bergen County, right across from Manhattan, is one of the only places in America where all four of their shopping malls are closed all day on Sunday. And then in Oklahoma, you can't buy a car there. Selling packaged liquor is prohibited on Sundays. Pennsylvania, you can't buy a car there. Texas gives you a choice. Your dealership can either be open on Saturday or Sunday, but not both days. And those are all blue laws that are still in play today. Now, the question in this case is the blue laws. Are they religious or are they secular? Because that will tell us how Mr. Brownfell will be able to do life here. So the blue laws are state laws which prohibit non-essential or certain forms of commerce on Sunday in order to create a uniform day of rest. And it's a day of rest for the community. They have their origins in the colonial period and were named for the color of paper which they were originally printed on. The Lord's Day, right? The Lord's Day to Protestants and to Catholics is what day? It's Sunday. But if we said Shabbat, we said the Sabbath, is really biblically the Sabbath on a Sunday? Mm-mm. Sundown Friday to sundown Saturday. And we have a number of Orthodox Jewish people living in America that when you talk about Sabbath laws, that's what they're thinking. That's their holy day. But as Protestants and as Christians, we look at Sunday as the Lord's Day. We'll even say it's the Sabbath. And so these origins do come, the Sunday origins come from the colonial period. It comes from the Puritans, and this is a day of rest with the family, and is also a day that's devoted solely to the Lord. That's when preaching back in the day used to be maybe 5 to 6, 7 hours. Now here, the appellant is Abraham Brunfeld. He owned and operated a clothing and home furnishing store in Philadelphia. He was also an Orthodox Jew. What day would be his holy time? Friday night, all day Saturday, or at least till Saturday sundown. His religion required him to observe Shabbat, the Sabbath, from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday by engaging in no work and closing his shop. Because of the revenue loss on Friday evening and all day Saturday, Brunfeld relied on being open on Sundays. And Brunfeld asserted that if he was required to also close his shop on Sundays in accordance with Pennsylvania's Blue Law, he would necessarily suffer economic hardship and would not be able to continue in his business. So basically he was saying, look, my religion says that I have to take Saturday off, and the Blue Law says that Sunday I can't work. So I'm out for an entire weekend. I can't operate that way. My business is done and finished. What he asserts is that he's required to close the shop on Sunday with the Blue Law. And with all of this, he is asserting an interference with his First Amendment right for the free exercise of religion. He's saying that because of the Blue Law telling him he can't work on Sunday, it's violating his free exercise for the Shabbat the day before. Now, the case was dismissed at the state level and appealed to the United States Supreme Court. The appellant in the case argued that the Pennsylvania statute was an attempt to establish a religion. And so what he was saying is that this Blue Law thing is Christian, and it comes from colonial Christianity, and the government is supporting it, so this is violating the Establishment Clause of the United States Constitution. And he's saying that because the Blue Law has emerged from Christian practice of refraining from work on Sunday. Also, they asserted that the statutes violated the 14th Amendment by not providing equal protection to people of different religious faiths. In a 6-3 decision, the court held that the Pennsylvania Blue Law did not violate the Free Exercise Clause. And that's an interesting thing. What the court is saying is the idea of the Blue Law isn't religious. It has, matter of fact, has nothing to do with it. Even though its earlier forms of it perhaps are related to, you know, colonial Christianity, the reason that we have blue laws in the United States is to provide federal workers, postmen and people like that, a day of full rest. And if we're doing that, then, you know, we think it's good for the community, we think it's good for the culture to have a full day of rest. And the court, in a 6-3 decision, denied Brunfeld and denied him the ability to work on Sunday and strike down the blue laws in Pennsylvania, because those said those blue laws were really secular, not religious. And don't try to go buy a car today in Minneapolis, because you're not going to get one. I told you the last case is the most disturbing. This case is a case with a young woman. Her name is Carrie Buck, and it's Buck v. Bell, 1927. There's a group of people in the country, in the United States at that time, that were into something called eugenics. Eugenics. And eugenics, eu means good, genics, combination of just your idea of your DNA and your culture, but the idea of having a good culture or a good group of people. And how do you do that? That's the bigger question. How is it that you're going to get a good group of people in a culture. This is a better baby contest that was held in Indiana in 1931, and they had judges and doctors that were looking at the physical and mental viability of every baby to see which babies were better than other babies. Unfit human traits, feeble-mindedness. Matter of fact, most of the mental facilities were called mental facilities for the feeble-minded during this time period. And you can see the different things in talking about epilepsy and criminality and insanity and alcoholism, and all marriages were eugenic, could breed out most of those kinds of people and get rid of them. And what their triangle is, you know, what you do is education, what you have is from your environment, and what you are is your heritage. Only the healthy seed must be sown was the cry of the people of the eugenics movement in the United States of America at the time. This was a board that they held that said, some people are born to be a burden on the rest. And you can see the light flashing. And it says, the light flashes every 50 seconds. A person is committed to jail by the United States. Very few normal persons ever go to jail. And you can see, learn about heredity and how you can help correct these conditions. And state hospitals and the government had ways of categorizing people back in the day. If you were mentally at a level of a three-year-old, you were called an idiot by the government. And then there were three levels of being called an imbecile, from low grade, medium, to high grade. And then if you were 10 to 12-year-old mentality, you were just called a moron. Now, this is all approved by our government. The lady on the left, her name is Carrie Buck. And Carrie Buck, that's her mom, Emma, right there. Both of them were put in different mental facilities in the state of Virginia, 1927. And Carrie lived with foster parents, and they pulled her out of school because they wanted her to work in their home more, doing the dishes and the cleaning and all kinds of things, almost like maybe a servant as opposed to someone that was working. One of the nephews came to their home. They raped Carrie, and she became pregnant. And the family that had her did not want to deal with the kid, did not want to deal with the shame of it. So what they did is they brought her to a mental hospital and committed her to a mental hospital. They put her in the mental hospital, and she had the baby. And the baby was adopted by the same couple that had sent her there. That couple actually, somehow, some way, got that kid to live a fairly normal life. But not for Emma and her mom. They lived in the same mental hospital this entire time. There's a guy by the name, his name is Dr. Pretty. He was a guy that was into eugenics. And the eugenics that he was interested in was a eugenics that would cause people like Emma, that were considered to be a burden on society, to no longer be that burden. But he was very frightened. There was a new law in Virginia that allowed doctors to sterilize people. And he very much wanted to sterilize Carrie. But he wouldn't do it until he knew he could get support of the government. So in a trial case, they said, we're going to sterilize her. And she got an attorney. The attorney she got was on the board of the hospital itself and was pro-eugenics, and that was her advocate. And so the case made it all the way through the state of Virginia, supporting the hospital's right to sterilize her, and went to the Supreme Court of the United States of America. That's Oliver Wendell Holmes. In a unanimous decision, 9-0, he sided on Carrie being sterilized. What he said, it's better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve from their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. His last quote was, three generations of imbeciles, it's enough. And he sent it back 9-0, and Carrie Buck was sterilized. Her sister went in for a simple appendectomy 4 years after that, and the doctors there also sterilized her sister because she was in that family unit and didn't tell her. And for 15 years, her and her husband tried having kids and had no idea why she couldn't get pregnant. In the state of California, you can see that among the 70,000 plus people that were sterilized during that time period, many of them were sterilized here in the state of California. A person that was really super interested into eugenics is this woman, Margaret Sanger, founder of Planned Parenthood. Let's take a deep breath and think about that for a moment. Controlling births and deciding who lives and who dies. Margaret Sanger was a huge proponent of eugenics. You know who else liked eugenics a lot? And they were in the Nuremberg trial and cited this case and others were the Nazi war criminals. And they said, you know what? That whole idea of sterilization, a big country like the United States and a powerful country, we learned it from you. And that was part of their defense, actually. But the moment that a government can take an image bearer of Jesus Christ and declare them to be an idiot or an imbecile or a moron and then have them sterilized is a very bad moment in the history of our country. When a fetus is inside of a woman and it's a live embryo, eugenics, it's the same idea, isn't it? Who is going to fight? Who's going to fight for the life that's inside of that woman? Talk about women's rights. What about human rights? Well, it's not really best for the child. Can't economically afford it. I don't want the imposition of having a child, so we'll murder it. A lot of what we see from Planned Parenthood and a lot of what we see in today's world was built on a very, very bad black eye for our country during this eugenics movement. And the Supreme Court and Oliver Wendell Holmes, who I spoke glowingly of last week, making a very, very bad decision, a horrible decision. And any time that we can decide as human beings who's good and who isn't is a bad time. Because we know biblically and theologically who is good. No one. God is good. But no human beings are. And for our government to sanction it, horrible. But I want you to see, and this is a hook I want you to see for when we come back in October, this is the connecting block to Roe v. Wade, to the way people think today. C.S. Lewis said, it's not up to the church organization to make a difference in the world and social issues like that. It's us, one by one, the billboard that we have as Christians, the platform we have with others to talk with them, to show them what it is. Philippians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9. We think it, it's here in our heart, and then we go do it. That's the kind of Christian that we need to be. That kind of Christian has a huge billboard, a big, bright billboard in a very dark world. So I'm hoping that after talking about all of these different things that we've talked about, some of them very difficult and some of them very good. You know, the Brown case is a very good case. This case, not so much. But what I hope is that not only will we be vigilant and that we will see and that we will respond, but we know that our response is going to be a response that is measured. It's not a crazy response. It's not yelling and screaming. We're to live good lives in this community, but we live them for Christ. Again, thinking about verse 8, chapter 4, here in our heart, and then putting it into practice. that will have the greatest impact that this world will ever see. Could you imagine if all Christians would do that? If we would all be in a place of living our faith out like that in the individual communities we dwell in, at work, at play, at school, that will make a difference. Christ will honor that. Let's pray. God, thank you so much for just the opportunity to look back in history. And as we pull back the covers of history, we find things that we're delighted about and think, wow, that's really, really good. And other times we find things that are quite disturbing. But one thing we know is, Lord, that you are immutable. You're a God who is faithful. And Lord, we know that in your immutability and your faithfulness to us, that you're a God who doesn't lie. You're a God who loves us. And in your love for us, you have not left us as orphans. You've given us your Spirit. You've given us a conscience. You've given us your word. And so, Father, I pray that we would use those tools that you have provided for us to minister to people. And as we minister to people, our goal is for the gospel to be propagated in this community. Our goal is to help people. We want to help people. And in doing that, Father, we pray that you would give us a heart for it, a heart, again, that has those attributes that are talked about in Scripture so often. God, we know that you love us. Help us to take the love that you've given us that we've never deserved and to reflect that love to a dark community, a dead and dying community, and also, God, within the church as an encouragement to one another. God, I pray for these people as they leave here today, God, that you would be with them this week, that you would bless them, that you would do good to them, and that you would help them even to discuss some of these matters this very week. God, we thank you that the gospel, that the cross of Christ will do so much more than anything else that we know. God, we just thank you for your Son who died for us, that we would have eternal life. God, we are not hopeless people. We are the most hopeful people on this planet. God, please do this for your people and do it for your glory, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.